Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
Well, look, this week, amid the Black Lives Matter movement and the further repercussions within culture and society, there's been a major reappraisal of comedy, from Little Britain to Ant and Dec to Fawlty Towers. Episodes and archive have been erased from online platforms. And on social media this week, there have been fears for an episode of Father Ted, which dealt with race. The episode called Are You Right There, Father Ted? Of course, Father Ted was played by the wonderful comic genius and much missed Dermot Morgan. And I'm now joined by Dermot's son, Don, who tweeted this week that all my family have left of my father is his work and reputation. He abhorred racism of every type and actively worked against it. Whilst insignificant compared to the suffering and upset of victims of racism, you might forgive me for feeling more than a little sad about this. Good morning, Don.
Good morning, Miriam. How are you?
Great. Thanks so much for joining us. I remember seeing that tweet and I was really touched by it. First of all, tell me about the episode in question. Just remind people, Don.
Yeah, well, the episode is... people will remember the episode as being where Father Ted, I suppose, comes a cropper in his attempts to ingratiate himself with the Chinese community of Craggy Island. And... During the course of it, I mean, the whole episode is basically how he tries to make good an initial misunderstanding, where he, after having famously stuck a lampshade on his head and done a highly inappropriate impression of a Chinese person, it just goes wrong from there on in, and as a result, he just basically by the end of the episode has to give up. He's a Nazi and he's seen as a racist. So basically misunderstanding with hilarious consequences.
We actually have a little clip of it, don't we, there, Sean? We might play it now.
Dougal, look.
I am Chinese, if you please. Come on, Dougal, lighten up. Chinese people there.
All right, yeah.
I mean,
that's the Yin family. They're living over there in that old Chinatown area.
Chinatown area? There's a Chinatown on Craggy Island? Dougal, I wouldn't have done a Chinaman impression if I'd known there was going to be a Chinaman there to see me doing a Chinaman impression.
Why not, Ted?
Because it's racist. They'll think I'm a racist. I'm going to have to catch up with them and explain I'm not a racist.
I watched the whole episode actually last night. I mean, it's a superb programme. What would you say to people who say, oh, but in the day, in, you know, this day and age, you can't even make jokes about anyone really, and that therefore one needs to be very, very careful about keeping programmes like this online?
Well, I think first of all, I mean, as I said... Miriam, there's two things I would say just at the outset. The first instance, I'd quote tweeted as I'd read this very interesting thread by Dean Van Nooyen about how, say, Little Britain, for instance, was a different set of circumstances to what, say, happened in Father Ted. The episode in Father Ted, the Chinese community element, which is obviously the comedy of misunderstanding, and people will likely find it very, very funny. There are things that are problematic in the episode with regard to the priests of Rugged Island dressed up as the Supremes in blackface. And that might be, I think, more of a contentious issue. But the problem is that from my point of view, as I said, it was more in sorrow than in anger. I'm not outraged or upset about anything in the sense that tastes and standards and viewpoints change over time. But I think the episode in and of itself is not offensive to the Chinese community in any way. I don't think there's any question of that. There was also no question of it being taken off. But there was a lot of chatter on social media, and I found it was the sorrow of kind of realizing that there is a shelf life perhaps to someone's legacy. And I was actually, believe it or not, Miriam, at the start of it, when he starts doing the Chinese man's sort of voice, the first thing that came into my head was Charlie Haigh. So maybe there's a resonance for something else there, but yeah. But I think that as I'm sure there should be a support group for the children of celebrities. My dad used to call them Hollywood children, but you do find yourself becoming aware about the fact that they're not there anymore to, I suppose, preserve their legacy. But you are, so you become quite sensitive to the fact that he can't speak up. So when you do see things like hashtags on Twitter saying cancel Ted and all this, it's like, okay, well, there we go. And that is, it's sad, and perhaps it is inevitable, but it is a healthy conversation to have.
Absolutely. But when you watch that whole episode, Don, I mean, he's really railing against racism for most of that episode.
Well, yeah. And Arthur and Graham wrote a beautiful episode, as there are many beautiful episodes of Ted. And I've said to many people, I think it owes as much to Samuel Beckett as Galton and Simpson. But it is the comedy of misunderstanding. But I suppose as our standards and attitudes change, it is the thing that I suppose music, for instance, will always kind of fall in and out of fashion. Like, no one listened to Bach for 100 years, and then in the 19th century became fashionable. But comedy can be different because the prism through which the humour is created or is seen can change. So when it comes to questions of race, it's a very, very hot topic at the moment, understandably. And in Ireland, as well as other countries in the Western world, we're looking at, you know, perhaps even in the lockdown, there's a certain amount of that where there's time for reflection on who we are as a people. And I suppose the comedy is that he isn't racist, but he just takes one inappropriate step after another. And it in the end, as you see when the sitting room is furnished with all the Nazi stuff. Mm-hmm. So the game over. I'm not even going to bother trying to explain this. It's just so what, that's the thing. Yeah.
What would you think if he might say if he was around today, Don, about this furore about comedy?
Honest to God, I don't know. And I'd like to say I unsuccessfully tried to ask him last night, but I suspect he would. Having studied Chaucer, he would look at it and go, well, that's just an inevitability, because comedy is something that is requires, you know, life. It requires somebody telling the joke and an audience both understanding the assumptions that underpin the humour. And that's why sometimes Chaucer, for instance, isn't necessarily very funny anymore, because he's 800 years old and you have to, you know, wade through old terms and attitudes and stuff like that to find the humour. So I think as time goes on, it becomes harder and harder sometimes to find what is funny. And humour in and of itself is an extremely wonderful human trait, where we laugh at things and everyone gets something out of it. But I would suspect that he would say, well, as time goes on, it's just going to become harder and harder.
It's still so loved here and in the UK, Father Ted. Do you find yourself watching it a lot, Don? And if you watch it, like your dad, he was so young. He was only in his mid-40s when he died. Does it make you sad to watch it, or does it make you laugh?
Well, I don't watch it terribly often anymore, but I when it is on the TV, it's kind of nice. I tried during the lockdown, I tried to show my three kids that there's your granddad. I don't know when the demand for Winnie the Pooh came, but their mind kind of strayed. They were fascinated by the fact, and my eldest son is also called Dermot, so he got excited because Dermot Morgan was up on the screen. He's like, that's my name. So from that point of view, I find watching Ted very it's lovely. And I have to say that, and I don't say it very often ever really, but I'm so grateful that he got the show, and I'm so grateful that Arthur and Graham thought of the show and thought of him, because he died so young. In hindsight, it's wonderful, because he's still knocking about, you know, and you do get to forget that he's dead, which is a relief sometimes. I'm sure you might relate to that, but it is something that I find very gratifying, I suppose. And I just, when I saw that stuff this week, and I thought nothing of it, I felt sad. I sent the tweet and I went about my business, and then I was like, well, okay, there's lots of reaction to this, whatever. But I did also see the fact that, because there is a conversation going on, and a necessary conversation about race, and in Ireland as well, are we a racist country? You bet we are, you know. And we do have uncomfortable truths that we have to look at in the eye. But at the same time, it was a very minor, and me from my privileged middle-aged white man's position, it does not take away from the suffering anybody feels, any person of color feels, or whatever else. I just for a moment kind of went, okay, well, you know, inevitably there's going to be, well, nothing lasts forever, if that makes any sense.
Do you find as you get older, Don, that you miss his presence more? I mean, your father died very young. So I often interview people, actually, who have lost a parent far too early. Do you miss him more now that you have children of your own? Or do you find it easier, I suppose, the length of time that goes on?
I don't think it gets any easier. Mm. And it's the C.S. Lewis line about the toothache. You know, you after a while, you just feel the numb pain or the dull pain. You forget what the cause of it is, but you know it's there. Mm. And he died very suddenly and very publicly. So for us, we lost him. And then there was the trauma of the loss that every person feels when they're bereaved. Mm. But then there was also the fact that it was a very public thing. And you're always reminded every single day of the fact that he's not there. People will always mention, oh, yeah, your dad and this. He was on the TV last night. Oh, was he a cast fella? I'll say it. And stuff like that. And so it's sort of like and as I get older and have my own kids, and Dermot, Peter and Harry are robbed of a wonderful grandfather. And they have one wonderful grandfather still alive, Paddy, who's a great guy. But I'm aware and slightly jealous, if that makes any sense. That we don't get to watch UCD on a rainy Friday night in the League of Ireland, and which is the best league in the world, and you know, those things I do feel robbed of, and I would often like to ask him his advice as I go on.
And also, is it harder when you have to share, I suppose, your grief with the public? I interviewed Kerry Kennedy last Sunday, actually, Don, Bobby Kennedy's daughter. And she was saying, you know, that's an interesting, you know, reaction, because she obviously had to deal with the world's grief about her father's death. But you here in Ireland, I'm like, that was a massive funeral. Mary McAleese was at it in Mount Marion. Did you find it more difficult that you had to share your grief almost with the entire country, or did that make it easier?
It was a complication. I think that's the best way of doing it, because the media will always have their eye on a story that they want to tell and a narrative that they want to get the circumstances to fit. I found it, and I suppose, again, if you ask anybody who has had a famous parent who's died and the aftermath has been very public, I suspect they will say that it is a complicating factor, because you don't really shut yourself away, because you will be reminded about it. I mean, I can't imagine what it's like for any of the Kennedys, you know, just thinking of Bobby, you know, keeping the dream alive and all that kind of stuff. I think you might find yourself, it's a complication. It's something that I find, again, it's nice as well to be able to talk to people, but the public nature of his death and the very public funeral, you know, in another life might have been preferable not to have. And But then again, I mean, I did love the idea at my father's funeral of Pat Kenny praying to a fire hydrant. I thought that was great. I thought that was a great mental image of him with a fire extinguisher just praying into it, because it was so full. But, you know, it has its benefits.
Do you find, they all say, everyone says we all become a bit like our mothers or our fathers. Do you find yourself being more like him as you get older or not?
Well, my kids are making fun of my belly. I don't know if that's what you're driving at, but I think the older you do find yourself that you're not as unique as you think you are, because you do sort of take on certain traits. I would certainly notice that as well. But then again, I mean, like I was watching a documentary about Jason Bonham, John Bonham's son, the drummer from Led Zeppelin, who's practically inhabited his father's life, and I don't think I do that. But when you see him, you go, yeah, you're just like your dad. And I suppose I would notice certain things that I become more and more like him. The ability to watch a black and white movie in the afternoon, despite all the chaos around you, is something I've developed, which is very similar to him.
Lots of nice texts about you, Dad, Don. Miriam, good morning. Please leave Father Ted alone. There's no comedy to compare with it. That's from Breda. Another says, hi, Miriam, Father Ted, and still is excellent. I saw Dermot in the Gaiety or the Olympia before he died, and he was brilliant there too. So sad he died so young. I visited the Father Ted house with my son last year. It was a lovely trip. Thanks to Dermot and his family for all the laughs. That's from Seamus. And one more. Margaret says, I treasured the lovely smile of Dermot Morgan in McDonald's in Nutgrove as I sat there with my two brown children and he a few tables away with his boys. So they're nice memories. So Don Finney, do you feel almost, you do feel you need to protect his legacy?
It's not even that I feel I have to. I think it's just an inevitability. And when you do see things, you do pipe up, because if you don't pipe up, somebody else will, and somebody else will have their speak. So I suppose you might feel obliged, but it's certainly sometimes it's just a reality of life. And I'm sure if you speak to anybody who has a famous parent who's deceased, they might feel very much the same way.
Great. And one more person, Rob Morgan says, delighted to hear you, Dom, plugging both UCD AFC and SSE Airtricity on Miriam this morning. Totally off topic, but most welcome. Yeah.
That's a story of my life. Totally
yeah,
off topic.
Absolutely. But listen, Dom, thanks so much for joining us and well done for protecting your dad's legacy.
Thanks, Miriam.
Thanks so much, Dick. Well, in 1976, when Christopher Ewart Biggs took up the role as British ambassador to Ireland, he believed he might be able to make a real difference and bring peace to this island. He brought his wife Jane and their three young children to Dublin, and they began to set up home and life here. However, within just 2 weeks, he was assassinated by a landmine planted in the road by the IRA. A 26-year-old civil servant called Judith Cook was also killed, and two men, Brian O'Driscoll and Brian Cubbon, were seriously injured. Just days after his murder, his wife Jane gave an extraordinarily powerful interview where she spoke of forgiveness and her lack of bitterness. She also said that she was determined to continue on the work of her husband. In subsequent years, Jane worked on peace projects alongside Murray Corrigan and Betty Williams in the North, and she also set up the Christopher Ewart Biggs Memorial Prize with its stated aim to promote peace and reconciliation in Ireland. Well, recently their daughter Kate Ewart Biggs, director of Global Networks for the British Council, published her own memories of that time. She was just 8 when her father was killed, and how the lessons helped her shape her life today. And I'm delighted to say that Kate joins me now on the line from London. Good morning, Kate Ewart Biggs.
Good morning, Miriam.
Thanks so much for joining us. First of all, tell me about your mum and dad. They seem such wonderful people. Yeah, your father, he was unusual for a man of his class, wasn't he? Because he was a socialist at heart.
Yes, he was quite unusual. He was definitely had kind of left leaning views, but also was essentially a pacifist, so had terrible kind of early experience in World War II as a very young man, an officer who he wasn't terribly athletic and really hated the whole kind of army environment, and you know, went off to war and lost his eye in his very first battle at El Alamein. And I think that really kind of shaped his kind of total abhorrence of violence in the world. So he was a sort of gentle, very, very clever man, I think, you know, and very cultured and loved books and reading. And essentially, yeah, and with these kind of views that didn't necessarily fit with the times in some ways.
And tell me about your mother.
Well, my mother was also an incredible person, really, and you know, up until my father died, she really led a life, you know, that was defined for women in those times. So she left school at 16. She was very bright, but didn't get given the opportunity to go to university, whereas her brother was. She then sort of launched into sort of secretarial life, and then met my father and became the wife of a diplomat, essentially. And, you know, she wrote a book called Pay, Pack and Follow, which is all about how the wife of a diplomat pays the bills, packs and follows. And actually the death of her husband led her into this sort of political campaigning world in a way that I don't think she would have had without that happening. So she grabbed the moment and did some amazing things in the rest of her life after his death.
And we'll come back to those, actually, Kate. Tell me about your family life before you moved to Dublin. I think you were about 8 when you moved to Dublin.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, we had all lived abroad, effectively. So my father's diplomatic career he was an Arabist, so took very young family to Algeria. My brother was born in Algeria. My sister was 2 when they moved there. And then they had a short stint back in the UK, and then he went on to the sort of European circuit. My sister had a a few kind of health problems that were fine in the end, but they didn't really want to go further beyond. And, you know, they were in Algeria during the War of Independence. I think it had been quite an intense experience. Mm. So he got onto the European circuit, was in Brussels, and then had 5 years in Paris. And then the move to Dublin happened. So we had a really lovely kind of, you know, interesting life with lots of energy and passion for their jobs, but also for the kind of whole diplomatic life. We grew up as bilingual kids, so we were all in French schools and spoke French fluently and had that kind of bilingual experience, which was wonderful. And yeah, we had a pretty lovely life, actually, I remember it as a kind of 8-year-old.
Did you know anything about Dublin or Ireland before you moved here? Like, can you remember when you were told, we're going to Dublin?
Yeah, I remember the moment really clearly, actually, and it's always shrouded in sort of secrecy in the diplomatic world. You know, you're not supposed to tell anybody about your next move until it's been sort of formalised. But I remember kind of lying under a desk at school with some friends and whispering to them in French. It was all in French, you know, all my friends were French, you know, that we were moving to this place. No, I didn't know anything about this at all, really. And then we had a short stint back in London before moving, where he would have had all his briefings and all that. So that was the first time I'd ever lived in London as well. So we had a couple of months in London. But no, I mean, I didn't know anything about it at all, but embraced it, you know, as a kind of energetic, excitable 8-year-old.
Remind people, I suppose, 1976, Kate, what were British-Irish relations like? I mean, would there have been apprehension, do you think, about your dad taking on such a role, especially after being, say, the ambassador to Paris?
Yeah, he wasn't actually the ambassador in Paris. He was the number two there. I think it was a really, I mean, you will know well, it was a really bad time in Anglo-Irish relations and in the Troubles. And I think the appointment of my father, who was probably quite a high-ranking diplomat, was a sort of signal that they wanted, the UK wanted to move the relationship on in a positive way. And he'd been, you know, quite open about that and about his ambitions and had done quite a lot of kind of press interviews beforehand. So I think, you know, rather than going in and kind of doing a more behind the scenes and quiet diplomacy, I think he was really up for, you know, trying to create a real step change in the relationship. And that was supported by the Foreign Office, I suppose, at the time. So I think there was obviously anxiety and apprehension. I think he hadn't probably really thought through the risk to himself or his family very acutely. And, you know, it happened so soon after we got there that I think that journey, he hadn't really gone on that journey, I don't think.
Do you mind me taking you back to the day your dad died? I know you were only 8. I've read what you wrote about it. It's really very moving, Kate. But just for my listeners, can you bring us back to that day?
Yeah, I mean, I remember it very well. And I was only 8, but it's sort of the bits around it are really fuzzy. The days after it, and the days before it, I suppose. But that actual day is very clear in my mind, you know. So my mother was actually in London. She'd gone to do some, you know, finding stuff for to make the house into a sort of, you know, a family home and buy some things. And so she'd travelled the night before, I think, on the ferry. So she wasn't there. So I woke up in the morning and knew that she wasn't there. So I padded into his room and actually spent the morning with him before he went to work. So, you know, was there with him having breakfast in his room and, you know, while he got dressed, and I actually chose his tie. And then I remember him not wanting to go, and there was a visiting, I think he was a PUS at the time, actually, of the Northern Ireland office, was visiting from the UK with his young private secretary. And I remember they all went off together in the car, not wanting them to go, really. And you know, missing my mum and stuff. So I went out into the garden after they'd left, and I'd made friends with the son of the driver who'd driven them off. They lived in a house nearby. So I was playing with him, and we actually heard this sort of loud noise, and we kind of looked at each other and just carried on playing. And then, you know, there was a strange day. I think, you know, my brother and sister, who are older than me, were told. So they were visibly upset, but I didn't know why. So nobody told me, but I knew something had happened. I thought my mother died, actually, because she wasn't there. So I thought that's what had happened. And then somebody told me that she was coming back early. And then we went out to another diplomatic family's house, and, you know, we had to drive through all these, you know, kind of army checkpoints that had been set up around the house. And I had no idea what was going on, and nobody would really tell me. And I knew they were hiding something from me, so I was quite cross more than anything. And then I remember I was outside, you know, riding my bike, and this whole kind of cavalcade of cars arrived, and my mother got out of one and kind of picked me up, and I think she was probably crying. And I kind of knew in that moment that he died. I just sort of didn't need to be told, really. And then it all goes quite blank, and I don't remember much.
Your mother was extraordinary, wasn't she, Kate? How did she react after it? She got extraordinary strength.
Yeah, she did an interview a few days after it happened, which is, you know, I watched it actually a while ago. And, you know, she came out and wanted to thank people for the support that she got from Irish people and all the letters. And she also wanted to sort of confirm that, as far as she was concerned, she wanted to continue the ideals of my father, which were all about peace and reconciliation and forgiveness. And she made a very public statement about it. And I think that it was a really defining moment, actually. And I look back on it now that I'm an adult and think what an amazing thing that was to do, because she could easily have done the opposite, or she could have done nothing. And she chose to do something very proactive and to reach out. And she was determined that, you know, the death of this wonderful person wasn't going to be a waste, and she was going to continue to live his ideals. And that's what she did. She threw herself into that, effectively.
Christopher was a person who was particularly shocked by violence. And from the hundreds and hundreds of letters of sympathy that I've got from people in Ireland, I think you too are appalled by violence. But none of us can afford to be equivocal about violence. Christopher was destroyed by it. But I'm sure that Christopher's death will not be in vain. And I hope it will make us more determined to work for these ideals which we share with him. I feel no bitterness, but I ask you to remember these convictions which he had and felt so passionately, and which, more than anything else, I want to see bearing fruit. So will you commemorate his death by remembering his hopes? I believe in them, and I felt the warmth and kindness of the Irish people.
As I said, she probably wouldn't have emerged as this incredibly remarkable person, you know, had this not happened, in a way.
It's extraordinary, Kate, that a woman like that, whose husband is, you know, assassinated in broad daylight, can be so forgiving.
I think it was just her... I think it came very naturally to her. I don't think she overthought it. For her, it was the only way. You know, there wasn't any other way. Mm. And it was the natural thing to do for her.
What about you and your brother and sister? Did you find it more difficult to forgive?
I mean, I've never really thought about it, because it was just the way it was. Mm. And I have never... ever considered anything else, really, because that's what our lives became, really. And it never occurred to me that there could have been another reaction to it, really. Mm. I mean, look, we suffered from the loss of a father. There is no doubt about that. And, you know, one shouldn't underestimate, for all those people who've lost loved ones in the Troubles or in any other conflicts around the world, that there is a significant impact on a family. And we did that at times quite publicly, which at times was difficult. And we just wanted all the fuss to go away, really, you know, and to get on with our lives and be the same as other kids. You know, that's the sort of natural reaction from children. But in terms of, did we think about not forgiving? I speak for myself here, but it never occurred to me not to, you know, or that, in fact, that had even happened. It was just that we had this connection with Ireland, and we had this connection with Northern Ireland, and that continued throughout our lives. And that felt like a normal thing for us, you know.
Also, of course, on that day, you mentioned her earlier, a young civil servant called Judith Cook. I think she was only 26, lost her life.
I mean, terrible. And, you know, such a young woman, and by the sounds of it, with so much ahead of her. And for her parents, it must have been, you know, and her family and friends, the most horrific event. And I, you know, I think all the public attention went on to my father, because it was also political, etc. But you know, I've often thought about that family over the years, you know, and what a awful, terrible thing to happen to her and her family.
And you mentioned Brian O'Driscoll. I think he was the driver you were playing with his son. I think there was a man also called Brian Cubbin in it. They were injured. Did you stay in touch with them at all?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, in fact, I'm still in touch with Brian O'Driscoll and his children. And, you know, that was a really important relationship for us. And we didn't see them that often, but whenever we went to Dublin, we would always see them. And to this day, you know, the ambassador, previous ambassador in Ireland, actually did a really nice tree planting event at the residence on the 40th anniversary, and Brian was there, and you know, and we have this memorial prize that my mother set up, and he's always come to that, and it's been a really lovely connection. I think Brian Cubbin died a few years ago, but I think my mother was definitely continuing to be in touch with him. He was more seriously injured than Brian O'Driscoll, so was in hospital for a while, I think. But yes, she definitely had a connection with him over the years as well.
Sadly, you lost your mum. I think you were only 22, Kate. And as you said earlier, she really hit her stride. She was a strong voice in the House of Lords. It's incredible, though. Do you think you learnt all about forgiveness from her, and how you might have been shaped if your mother had reacted differently?
Yeah, I mean, I think she enabled me to you know, as I say, you know, the kind of trauma and grief was there, but I think it enabled me not to have to harbour any other feelings. And, you know, I'm really, really grateful to her for that. And also to understand the sort of connections between communities and countries and what that means in real life and in practical terms, so that, you know, her connecting into Ireland and Northern Ireland. She used to love going to Belfast, you know, and spending time with people and communities there. And she was really energized by it. And I watched her do that and was often with her. And I think that, I didn't know at the time, but I think it taught me a lot about this idea of connecting and connections around the world. But to do that, you can't just talk about it. You have to do something practical. And she was a very practical person. And that's what she did. She threw herself into those things. She set up this memorial literary prize. There was a community prize she set up. You know, she did a lot of campaigning. And that's how she led her life. And I think she was an amazing role model in that way. And I'm just sad that, you know, as I've become a fully fledged adult, as it were, I haven't had the time to talk to her about all of that, because she died so young, you know. And I would have loved the opportunity to look at the world from her perspective now, as it were.
If your dad hadn't been murdered by the IRA, would you think he might have been able to achieve, Kate, in pursuit of maybe better Anglo-Irish relations? Have you thought about that?
Yeah, I think he would have confronted it head on with all the complexity that is within it and beneath it. And I think he would have approached it, you know, from the perspective of conciliation, compromise, non-violence, you know, and I hope that he in his way would have moved it on. I mean, you know, it would have been some steps, wouldn't it? It wouldn't have been the whole thing, but I think that would have been his aim anyway. Well, how far he could have got, I don't know, but that would definitely have been the aim that would have driven him, and he would have continued to do that in his very kind of clever way, I think, you know.
Did it shape your own life and your own career choices? I know your subsequent career, at first you followed a degree, I think, in social anthropology, and it took you all over the world, to Brazil, to Uganda.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it did, actually. I think it's this thing I was talking about in terms of sort of wanting to connect with the world. And I suppose I also had this sense that life of moving around has kind of been taken away from me at quite a young age, less so for my brother and sister, who did more of it than me. But I kind of yearned for that often. And I set off with my rucksack very young, you know, and travelled a great deal. And then, you know, found a career which was all about kind of connecting around the world and, you know, making the world a better place through connections, you know. And I think it definitely shaped me, and her view on the world, without doubt, enabled me to look at it in that way. And I often wonder what she'd think now, you know, and whether she would have liked those choices. I think she always said that for her children, she wanted us to make some sort of contribution. It didn't matter what it was, but she wanted us to make a contribution, basically.
I saw a lovely picture of you with your daughter at that tree planting anniversary.
Yeah.
She is mixed race and half Ugandan. And now, obviously, right across the world, there's such a big conversation about race. Have you spoken to her about it? How does she react to it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we have. Well, she's been speaking to me about it, I would say, a great deal. She's 15 now and defines herself as black. And she's been a mixture of angry, upset, but also very impassioned by it, you know, and, you know, wants to do something. And like all young people, is doing that through the various online and digital routes that they have. But she wants to campaign. You know, she feels really strongly that her life matters and that the voices must be heard. And she thinks that it's going to be her generation that will change this. And I've been incredible. And she's reading and watching and educating herself and spending a lot of time talking to friends of all sorts of different colours about it. And, you know, I've been incredibly proud of her, actually. I've never seen her so passionate about something. And she's a black person. She, you know, she is defined by the world as being black, and she sees herself as black.
Do you wish that your daughter, Marley, that your parents, your mum and dad, had been able to meet her?
Oh, yeah, I mean, very definitely. I mean, you know, I think Marley brought into the kind of Ewart Biggs family this sort of wonderful mix of cultures, you know, and I think they would have both really loved that. And, you know, particularly actually with my mother, I think, you know, I feel like I've missed so much of her not being here for so many defining moments. And when I had Marley, I missed her more than ever, actually, because I wanted to hear about her experience, you know, and what it had been like for her. And you don't ask those questions when you're in your early 20s of your mother, because you haven't experienced it yet. You haven't done anything yet. And, you know, so as I started my first job, so I juggled parenthood and work and all of those things that she did, you know, I've wanted to ask her about it and I haven't been able to. And that has felt sad, I must say. You know, but, you know, we live on, you know, they live on inside of all of us. And I feel like Marley kind of is quite like my mother, actually. She has a sort of determination about her that is quite familiar.
And if your mum was here, what do you think she would say to Marley right now?
I think she'd say, make your contribution, you know, contribute to it and be clear about your contribution and don't give up when you feel like people are not on your side. You know, race is a really complex issue, and, you know, living in quite a white world in many ways in the UK, you know, she will encounter people not really wanting to kind of listen to it or finding it very difficult to address those issues as white people, and she's just got to keep going. And I think that's what my mother would have said to her.
Well, Kate, it's been a real privilege to talk to you. I loved reading. It's called Skiing Uphill, actually, by you, Kate Ewart Biggs. If people want to read it, I assume they can read it on the British Council website.
Yeah, please do get people to have a look. It's in a publication called Lives Entwined. And effectively, it's a set of amazing essays. I mean, mine is just one of them. Brilliant writers who've contributed to this continuing set of series of looking at the relationship between Britain and Ireland over the years. And it's a good read, not just mine, but many of all of the articles in it are really great. So yes, please do. It's on the British Council website. People can go onto it. If they either go onto the Northern Ireland or the Ireland or even the main website, they'll find it.
Kate, thank you so much. And, you know, we're so sorry in Ireland about what happened to your father, but they'd both be so proud of how wonderful you turned
you
out. Thanks so much, Kate.
All right, Miriam.
Take care. Mind yourself.
Right.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, yesterday we saw a continuation across the water of the riots and protests that began in the US after the death of George Floyd. In London, there were 100 arrests. It's two very different protests took to the streets, those from Black Lives Matter and those from Britain First. After the statue of Edward Colston was toppled in Bristol and the threats to Winston Churchill's, there have been many debates about Britain's colonial past. So what of its attitude to us, the Irish? How did it treat us in our striving for freedom? Well, former Tory minister and now television presenter Michael Portillo has just made a new two-part documentary on the War of Independence, which begins this coming Wednesday, June the 17th at 9:35 on RTE1. And he joins me now. Good morning, Michael Portillo.
Good morning, Miriam.
Thanks so much for joining us. I watched both of them and I really enjoy them. They're superb. First of all, it follows on from your, of course, Enemy Files, which was about the Easter Rising. Did you ever think you'd spend so much time telling Irish stories?
In a way, I'm not surprised. I'm you know, extremely interested in history. I read it at university. I was only ever up to graduate level. I wasn't a postgraduate, but my interest was British and European history in the 19th and 20th centuries. So I knew the outlines of the stories that I'm telling now, but very much only the outlines. And I was just very thrilled when I was invited to make these now two series. And as you say, the first series was called Enemy Files because the whole point is, my perspective is to look at this from the point of view of the British government. So what were the documents that came out of the British government, the diaries, the cabinet papers, the military orders, the letters between the main players. And we trace the attitudes of the British. In the first series, it was during the Easter Rebellion, and now the War of Independence between 1919 and 1921.
It's fascinating because you carry your, obviously, leather folder with these previously unseen documents. For my listeners, Michael, tell them what was happening with the British government at that time in terms of its relationship with Ireland.
Well, I think the first thing to say is that the British government was very much distracted by everything else. It had just fought a war in which it had been victorious, and the Prime Minister, David Lloyd George, was principally concerned with making the peace and really reshaping the world. So incredibly, as the War of Independence gets going, he isn't even in Britain. He's living in France. He's living in Paris and going to Versailles. The administration of Ireland is at first in the hands of what I would call the hawks. One of them is the First Lord of the Admiralty, Walter Long, and the other is the Lieutenant General, who's John French. And they simply see Irish policy as a matter of crushing dissent. They see the IRA as a criminal organisation, and it has to be flattened basically by police action. And, of course, the police is increasingly militarised by the creation of the Black and Tans and the auxiliaries. But as the story evolves, then Lloyd George applies a bit more attention to the subject. The personnel in Dublin Castle who are administering Ireland begin to change over, and a more dovish approach emerges. That is to say, people who are willing to think about negotiation. And to the extent that the British are engaged with the subject at all, I think that their priority is to make sure that Northern Ireland is going to be secured, that it will be spared from home rule. After all, the British had negotiated home rule even before the First World War, but had not implemented it because they couldn't think of a solution for how to satisfy unionist opinion in the North. And the war really comes to an end once unionist opinion has been bought off by the creation of a parliament in Belfast. And then the British are willing to make very considerable concessions to Green Ireland, as long as they're not creating, at that stage, a Republic of Ireland. That is just a stage too far. And there are people on the IRA Sinn Féin side, like Michael Collins, who realise that there's a limit to how far the British are going to go at that stage. And that's how it's possible to make a negotiated settlement in 1921.
Were you surprised at what you found in terms of the British attitude to Ireland? I mean, there's been a lot spoken about, Michael, in recent times, racism, you know, colonisation. I mean, do you think one of the key problems was that England's racist attitude to us here in Ireland was to blame for its inability to control us?
I don't know that racism would be the appropriate word in this instance. I mean, after all, you know, the Irish people are one set of people, although two religions and two communities. Mm. And of course, the British had very strong relationships with the Unionist community. And by the way, when the King came to Belfast to open the new Northern Ireland Parliament in 1921, he spoke most affectionately, and I think, judging by the documents, most sincerely, about what he felt about Ireland, how warmly he felt about Ireland. And he looked back on the period that he spent in Ireland as a midshipman with a great deal of warmth. So I don't think it's quite that. Mm. But I do think that the British, you know, did not understand the political aspiration of the Irish. Ireland had been a terrible nuisance to them for a long time. You know, a lot of people had perished through murder and outrage in Ireland. And even when the British had come round before the First World War to negotiating and legislating home rule, even that proved not to be a solution, because then there were two islands. There was a Northern Ireland and a Green Ireland, and they weren't going to agree. So I think the British kind of found it a terrible nuisance. And then, of course, having triumphed over Germany, couldn't quite understand that they were being defeated by a rebel army.
When you look, though, at details, I suppose, the black and tans, there are very emotive subjects for many people in this country. I mean, would you accept that was a key problem? They should not have sent in the black and tans.
Yeah, I think one of the great mysteries of all of this, I think the British lose the war militarily, that's true, but fundamentally they lose the propaganda war, and that is what matters. I mean, for example, Churchill switches from being a great hawk to being something of a dove. That is, at least he thinks there should be negotiations, because the reprisals that the British have taken, the sacking of Balbriggan, the burning of Cork, the outrages by the Black and Tans and the auxiliaries, have done such damage to the British reputation in Britain, in the Empire, and in particular in the United States. And that's what particularly engages the mind of Winston Churchill, that the United States is furious with Britain. So the British really lose the war for themselves by a lack of discipline with their armed forces. And they lose the key advantages that they had, apart from military superiority, which were prestige and legitimacy.
Interesting. And I mean, interesting, you start yourself as a hawk, didn't you, in your political career, hardline Thatcherite. But over time, I think you say this yourself with your role as Secretary of State for Defence, then obviously agreeing to talks with the IRA. You say you've become more of a dove yourself.
Yes, to me it was quite interesting that the process that the British government goes through between 1919 and 1921 was pretty similar to the process that it goes through at the time of the recent troubles leading up to the Good Friday Agreement of 1998. So I was in government with John Major as Prime Minister until 1997, and I was on the Northern Ireland Committee because I was Defence Secretary, and that was the committee which gave permission to the Prime Minister to begin negotiations. And so, yes, we had all made that journey. A couple of differences. One is that, you know, it had taken us about 30 years since the troubles had begun in 1969, much longer than it took in 1919 to 1921. The other thing is that whereas in 1919, 1921, the British were clearly losing the war militarily as well as propaganda, it wasn't the case in 1997. In 1997, the number of casualties suffered by the British forces had been reduced to very low single numbers, and even in some years to zero. So the position from which we launched into those negotiations was slightly different. But nonetheless, the parallels between the two periods are quite striking.
Yeah, and the programmes are superb. I can't let you go without asking about Brexit. It's a big issue here in Ireland for us. You, of course, are a Brexiteer. Are you still happy that you've left the EU?
Oh, yes, I'm happy that we've left the EU. I'm not happy that it looks as though, at the moment, we're not going to get an agreement. I think it would be much better for the end of our transition period to coincide with an agreement, you know, around tariff-free trade and so on. But that's not looking very good at the moment. Nonetheless, there might be a last minute, there might be a breakthrough. Let's hope so.
That's pretty gloomy. I mean, if you were in politics today, A, would you like to be in politics at the moment? And would you give advice to Boris Johnson about trying to do a deal with the EU so there is, not at the end of the day, no deal?
Would I like to be in government today? I mean, I wouldn't object because I think, you know, I think all periods of politics are absolutely fascinating. In my own case, I've done enough of it. My career in politics came to an end many years ago. But it's not that I think, you know, today is a disagreeable period to be in politics. And if you're saying, would I urge Boris Johnson to go soft on Brexit? No, absolutely, I would not. I mean, obviously, we're looking for compromise, but it does look from this side of the water as though the European Union has not quite cottoned on to the fact that we are leaving the European Union and we want to be treated like a sovereign nation, much on a par with the way the European Union has behaved towards other sovereign nations like Norway and Canada, for example.
Final quick question, and just to remind people, your documentary begins this coming Wednesday, RT1, 9:35. It's a superb watch. Did you change your attitude to us in Ireland during the course of you making these programmes, Michael?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I came into Parliament because my predecessor had been murdered by the IRA at the Brighton bombing. And Erin Eve was quite a good friend of mine, and Ian Gow was a very good friend of mine. So, of course, you know, during my political career, I felt a great deal of sorrow and bitterness about what had happened there. On the other hand, whenever I've been to Ireland, and I think even when I was minister, but certainly since I've been filming there, I can't tell you how I'm struck by the warmth of the welcome. You know, I walk through the streets of Cork and people just stop and say, "You're so welcome in Cork, you're so welcome in Dublin," whatever. And this is truly impressive. I mean, when I was filming at places like Solihull, and people who'd come to the memorial there stopped me, I was kind of in fear and trembling, wondering what they were going to do to me. And they simply said, "Oh, we just love your documentaries about rail travel." And I couldn't quite believe this level of magnanimity, but, you know, because after all, I was a part of the British establishment. I was a Tory minister. So has my attitude to Ireland changed? I mean, our relationship is so complicated, isn't it, with these contradictions. Mm. But a part of the contradiction is this extraordinary warmth which the Irish express, and by the way, which I express back towards them.
OK, well, look, Michael Portillo, thanks so much for taking the time to speak to us this morning. As I say, the documentary goes out this coming Wednesday, RT1 9:35. Thanks so much for joining us.